Howdy, and welcome to another action-packed episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media at home on the range. I'm Richard Prosh, and with me, getting his finger stuck in the knot while trying to tie down his holster, is my co-host Paul Bishop. How are you, pal?
Apparently, I'm all fingers and thumbs when it comes to making this thing secure to my legs.
You never cease to amaze me. It's supposed to be just one leg, partner, not both. How about extraditing yourself long enough to tell us about the features for this episode?
Today, we're pinning on our Lone Star badge and riding out with the Texas Rangers, a law enforcement agency of which I'm proud to be a sworn member.
You are not.
Am too.
Really? I can never tell if you're kidding or not.
I'm actually not kidding. As an LAPD detective, I was assigned to a joint federal task force with the FBI. In order to be able to exercise federal jurisdiction, myself and the three other LAPD detectives assigned to the task force were all sworn in as Texas Rangers.
That's amazing. So did you get a badge and everything?
Unfortunately, not the badge, but I still have the signed authorization document swearing me in as a Texas Ranger.
Man, you are nothing if not full of surprises, partner.
However, it's no surprise the real history of the Texas Rangers, the professionalism of the Texas Rangers today, and the portrayal of Texas Rangers in books, movies, and TV rarely have anything in common.
And because of how much information there is about the Texas Rangers and their impact on pop culture, we're going to go ahead and do a two-part episode format again.
Between our two-part episodes focusing on Custer, Buffalo Bill, the Pony Express, Jesse James, and most recently Billy the Kid, this is getting to be a habit.
It is, but the longer we do the show, Paul, and the more research we do for each episode, the more great stuff there is to share with our listeners, which often means breaking the episodes down into a couple parts.
There is no getting around that argument, partner. But before we get to part one of our controversy-filled feature on the Texas Rangers, we've got a book review as well as a quick assessment of a couple of Western movies, one new and one recently restored to 4K glory. Why don't you start us off, Rich?
Sure. A while back, I read The Long Trail North by Harry Sinclair Drago. It's a fairly tight story following the misadventures of a young Wish Haggard as he leaves Ogallala, Nebraska for Texas and travels back up the trail with the herd of cattle and a variety of bad men. Drago writes some memorable scenes with stock characters. For example, when Haggard works as a ranch hand, he passes himself off as an intellectual and haunts the big ranch house library, borrowing books but always finding excuses not to discuss them so that he can just visit the boss's daughter. That's a nice subplot, even though the daughter is just a kind of a cardboard cutout character. The characters in this title are not exactly anti-heroes, but all of them are afflicted with self-doubt and immaturity. Drago keeps it fairly compelling through the pages. I was reminded of something I read once about Steve Ditko, the co-creator of Spider-Man. As writer Stan Lee pushed the evolving Marvel style of flawed superheroes to include Iron Man with his heart condition and Thor and a revived Captain America and others, Ditko didn't like that. Lee pointed out that Spider-Man is always full of existential angst and Peter Parker is always self-doubting. And Ditko replied that Parker was an immature kid, but his character should go through that kind of thing while the older heroes shouldn't. That one day, Peter Parker would grow to be an adult and quit whining and become more rational. Lee didn't see it that way.
Obviously, and it's hard to tell which one of them would be right.
Yeah, and Drago has his characters grow kind of along the same lines of what Ditko describes. They start out at the beginning, they're all kind of immature and whiny, and then they kind of grow through some changes, and at the end of the book, they all have changed. One thing I didn't like is that Drago has a regular habit of calling a character by both his first and last names throughout the narrative. And we've talked about that, Paul, on the Men's Paperback Adventure book list on Facebook. It's kind of a conceit that a lot of older authors have. For instance, while a character named Wish Haggard, Drago will have Wish go get the mail, but Haggard carries it back. And they're the same guy, but if you're not paying attention as you read, it can get kind of mixed up.
I agree. I don't like it when they do that. It's very irritating.
But otherwise, it's a pretty good book.
Moving on to the movies, The Harder They Fall, which premiered recently on Netflix, is a new hybrid Western, sort of a spaghetti, blaxploitation, revisionist take on the traditional Western bloody revenge saga, filled with ultra-violent scenes set to an Afro-infused reggae beat, with writer-director James Samuel alternately channeling Quentin Tarantino and Sergio Leone from start to finish. And oh yeah, a little Baz Luhrmann in its costumes and at times manic scenes. It's a slick, suave, black-centric account of real-life black characters who rode the Wild West range, such as Nate Love, Rufus Buck, Stagecoach Mary, and Cherokee Bill. These characters are played by Jonathan Majors, Idris Elba, Zazie Beetz, and Lakeith Stanfield, respectively, but whose motivations and misadventures have little to nothing in common with their real-life counterparts. The big deal about The Harder They Fall is the entire main cast is black, and the writer and director is making a statement about how 1 in 4 cowboys were black, but that ratio is never seen on the screen in the traditional Western movies. Now, that may be an admirable goal, but I don't really care if there's a social statement being made. All I want to know is if the film is a good Western or not.
And the answer is?
Meh, we've seen this all before. Sure, there's some fancy camera work, some fancy special effects, some cool music, and some good performances by the cast, especially Idris Elba, who I'd be happy to watch if he was reading an old-fashioned phone book. But the bottom line for me is, for all of its social consciousness, even hitting us over the head with it when the characters enter an all-white town, which has literally been whitewashed from top to bottom, it really brings nothing new to the genre and kept messing with my willing suspension of disbelief. Is it enjoyable? Is it worth watching? It's a mixed bag. If the switching up of the traditional Western social agenda played out by an outstanding cast of black actors interests you, and if you don't mind the hyper-violence of films such as Django Unchained or Hateful Eight, you dig the hybrid music and you are not fazed by the constant foul language that would make even Dibwood blush, then it's worth saddling up for. But viewed strictly as a Western, the Emperor, or in this case the Sheriff, has no clothes. Frankly, I despised it as a hollow piece of filmmaking, with the only thing connecting it to the Western genre is the cosplay Western costumes worn by the actors.
Okay, other than that, how did you like the play, Mrs. Lincoln?
Yeah, a harsh assessment perhaps, and it's strictly my opinion. The movie certainly has its supporters with both critics and viewers.
So the saying holds true, if you like this sort of thing, this is the sort of thing you're going to like.
Well, thank you for that. Round and around we go.
For a more traditional movie that actually stretches the main character involved, there's the beautifully restored 4K DVD release of McIntosh and TJ, starring none other than Roy Rogers in his last starring role.
This is very cool. Roy Rogers is a movie legend who I know still lives in both of our hearts. But if there's one criticism to be made about films starring Roy Rogers, is that no matter the name of Roy's character in any of his films, he's still Roy Rogers. He always simply played himself. He played himself very well, but his roles hardly stretched him as an actor. I haven't seen it yet, but I understand, as you said, McIntosh and TJ is an exception to the rule.
McIntosh and TJ was originally released in 1975. Roy's most recent prior screen appearance had been in the 1952 Bob Hope film, Son of Paleface. He was lured out of retirement for McIntosh and TJ by a solid script with a lead role written specifically for him in a story that is a heartwarming and affectionate tale about a hard-ridden cowpoke of yesterday and his restorative friendship with a cocky would-be delinquent of tomorrow. The supporting cast includes Joan Hackett, Billy Green Bush, Andrew Robinson, James Hampton, and Luke Askew. Waylon Jennings composed the original score, with Jennings and Willie Nelson providing feature songs for the soundtrack.
What about Trigger?
Yeah, he is definitely missed, but Roy's old pal Trigger was too busy riding the heavenly range to make an appearance, so his role is filled by a battered Ford pickup.
I guess old Nellie Bell wasn't available either. Probably lost her looks and needed to be replaced by a vehicular version of a trophy wife.
If you say so. But since you mentioned trophy wife, Dale Evans is not in the film either, leaving Roy as McIntosh to get his comfort from a shelf of the world's great books.
Not quite the same. I figure Roy felt it was much nicer to snuggle up to Dale on a cold night than a battered shelf of well-read books, no matter how great they are.
Careful, you're getting awfully close to that chilling image you get in your head when you realize your parents had to be intimate at least once.
That's something you can't unimagine.
Roy and Dale are from a time when everyone slept in single beds on the screen, so the books, I guess, do serve their purpose. Film historian and six-gun justice deputy Stuart Rosebrook calls McIntosh and TJ a late 70s contemporary western in which Roy Rogers' character McIntosh seems to be an amalgamation of characters we saw in Junior Bonner, J.W. Coop, and the Honkers, men out of time, men who have values, who still follow the code of the West. Courtney Joyner, another of our six-gun justice deputies, claims McIntosh and TJ isn't a Roy Rogers movie. Instead, it's a wonderful movie with Roy Rogers in it. The plot and conflict inherent in the screenplay are fairly mild by today's over-the-top scenery chewing. However, it uses its simple storyline as a way of defining and developing the character. There's homespun feel to every part of the whole, including the magnificent cinematography and a sweet gingham softness to the way real people in a still rough area of America are shown, all without Hollywood sensationalism. He may be in his autumn years, but Roy still looks as if he could still handle anything a gang of villains might throw at him. His performance here is genuine and deeply moving, while still filled with his trademark good humor and sage advice. McIntosh and TJ is a satisfying experience and a throwback to the heart of the best of American Westerns.
I've got to get this on my viewing queue. It sounds like something I'll really enjoy. I also want to give a quick shout-out to our amigo Ron Fortier over at Airship 27, who's just published a very cool collection of Western novellas under the title Marshall Horn of Talon's Crossing by Tyler Offhammer. Like all the things from Airship 27, this is a quality project and well worth your time and cash.
Okay, with our reviews out of the way, how about we let loose the cattle and get on with our feature?
While the Texas Rangers of today are one of the most respected and storied law enforcement agencies in the world, the early history of the Texas Rangers is something of a two-edged sword. The long-standing heroic tales of the Texas Rangers have more recently become entwined with a darker recidivist history of cold-blooded violence and racist accusations.
Unfortunately, the sources regarding the history of the Texas Rangers most often fall on either end of the spectrum. Indestructible paragons of justice and protectors of the innocent, or vile, bloodthirsty killers perpetrating racial genocide under a color of authority. There seems to be little academic acknowledgement of any middle ground.
That said, the laudatory perception of the Texas Rangers remains prevalent in popular culture and among both historians and the general public. But it remains true that the story of the Texas Rangers contains many heroic acts of bravery, but there are also moments that certainly challenge our idea of the Ranger as a noble lawman.
The concept of Rangers has existed for hundreds of years. They were militiamen, usually volunteers, mustered into company service to protect homes and families from enemy attacks. These groups included Rogers Rangers in the French and Indian Wars and Spanish-Mexican flying companies in the early Southwest.
Called men who could not be stampeded by Colonel Homer T. Garrison, Jr., the Rangers came into their original existence in 1823 when, unsatisfied with the protection being provided to Texicans by the Mexican government, entrepreneur Stephen F. Austin augmented the corrupt Mexican militia police with his own force of 10 men, paying them with his own private funds. The company was led by Lieutenant Moses Morrison. Austin is referred to by historians as the father of Texas, or more specifically, the founder of Anglo-Texas, for leading the second and ultimately successful colonization of the region by bringing 300 families and their slaves from the United States to the Tejano region. Austin charged the Rangers with patrolling the roads and wilderness for errant thieves united with Indians. Many of the men who volunteered as Rangers lived in Austin's settlement and hoped their service would help protect their own families from attack by American Indians. Some were also motivated by the desire to take revenge on American Indians for past raids.
During the Texas Revolution in 1836, the provisional government authorized the first official government-sanctioned ranger force to patrol the Texas frontier and protect settlers. Though this force was reorganized after Texas won its independence from Mexico, it continued to function in much the same way. Groups of volunteers were organized as they were needed to patrol and protect the frontier, then disbanded when their specific missions were done. After the 1836 Texas Revolution, a wave of new settlers headed to Texas, enticed by acres of land offered for little money. This increased settlement led to conflicts with American Indians who already occupied the territory and a renewed desire to send the Texas Rangers out on patrol.
To protect the new Texans, Ranger companies patrolled the frontier as well as the border with Mexico. It was during this time that John Jack Coffee Hayes became the most famous Texas Ranger of the era. Fighting in some of the period's most significant battles between Texans and American Indians, Hayes quickly proved himself to be a strong leader, smart decision maker, and fearless and brutal fighter. He rose up the ranks quickly and was soon leading Ranger companies on frontier patrols and in battles against American Indians. The Rangers themselves quickly earned the sobriquet Los Diablos Tejanos, the Texan Devils. Hayes and the Texas Rangers played a crucial role in securing the Texas-Mexico border during the 1840s. They became the terror of organized groups of thieves and bandits who crossed the Rio Grande into Texas to rob travelers and rustle cattle before fleeing back to Mexico to sell their stolen goods.
These bandits operated under the protection of Mexican Captain Ignacio Garcia, who received a percentage of the profits. In response to the increasing number of attacks, Hayes was given broad legal powers to track down the thieves and execute them without trial. Each ranger was armed with a rifle, a pistol, and a knife, a Mexican blanket tied behind his saddle, and a small wallet in which he carried salt, ammunition, and perhaps a little spiced and sweetened parched corn and tobacco for an entire month. Equipped in this manner, a small squad of rangers, unencumbered by baggage wagons or pack trains, could move as lightly over the prairie as the Indians.
During the Texas Revolution, the Texas Provisional Government authorized rangers to be paid $1.25 per day, plus $5 per month for food and supplies. Officers earned $50 to $60 per month. However, the men had to provide their own horses, tack, weapons, and ammunition. On December 29, 1845, Texas became part of the United States. The boundaries established led directly to a war with Mexico. Many current and former Rangers joined the fight. Using the skills that they had honed battling American Indians in Texas, the Rangers quickly made a name for themselves as bold fighters during the U.S.-Mexican War, which was waged between 1846 and 1848. Their scouting and tracking skills also helped locate Mexican camps and guerrilla fighters both during and after the war. The Rangers' prowess in battle was striking, and by the end of the war, the name Texas Ranger evoked images of fierce fighters and expert trackers around the world.
Unfortunately, the Rangers' behavior in other areas would directly contradict their heroic battlefield reputation. After the Battle of Monterey, one group of Rangers burned homes and killed as many as 100 civilians. Others stole whiskey and livestock from Mexican peasants. General Zachary Taylor said of the Rangers under his command, "There's scarcely a form of crime that has not been reported to me as committed by them."
By the mid-1840s, gun manufacturer Samuel Colt heard that his five-shot Patterson revolver had served Texas Rangers well in their fights against Comanche warriors. In 1846, Colt approached Texas Ranger Samuel Walker to ask how the gun could be improved. From their discussions, the larger, more powerful Colt six-shooter was born. Colt even engraved a scene from one of Ranger Jack Hayes' most famous battles against the Comanches on the cylinder.
With the U.S.-Mexican War behind them, the Rangers returned their focus to patrolling the frontier and tracking the Indians, this time with a more aggressive approach. Instead of responding to attacks after they happened, the Rangers began tracking tribal movement and going on the offensive. In 1858, Texas Ranger John Ford led 100 Rangers in a six-month campaign against the Comanches. The Rangers were joined by an equal number of Tonkawas, who were traditional enemies of the Comanche. Working together, the Rangers and Tonkawa tracked Comanches with orders to punish them for the devastating raids they had conducted in Texas.
Ford and his men pursued Comanche raiders to Indian territory, crossed the border without permission, and then followed them to their permanent camp on Little Robe Creek. There, the 200 fighters from Texas attacked 600 Comanches. Despite the uneven numbers, the Rangers' superior firepower helped them win the battle. They killed 80 Comanches and lost only one of their own in the fight. For many, the victory confirmed that Texas needed to rely on its Ranger force and not the U.S. Army for protection. Heedless of the lives lost, The Rangers' new, more aggressive approach became standard practice for the next 20 years. It only ceased when the U.S. Army and the Texas Rangers forced nearly all American Indians out of Texas.
With the threat of Indian attacks curtailed, more and more settlers poured into the frontier, invariably leading to new forms of conflict. The Texas legislature, having approved the first permanent Ranger force in 1874, and ordered the Rangers to keep the peace when violence broke out over control over a number of salt lakes.
During the fence-cutting wars in the 1880s between ranchers who wanted to keep the range open and those who wanted to fence in their land and livestock, the Rangers tracked down and arrested accused fence cutters. The Rangers also assisted local law enforcement when the Sabine County Sheriff asked for help bringing in the Connor Gang, which was terrorizing the entire county. The Rangers became such a regular presence in rural areas that one publication nicknamed them Prairie Patrolmen.
The violent style of law enforcement practiced by the Rangers continued to cause controversy and outrage. By 1901, state government stepped in and shrank their numbers significantly. However, the Rangers continued to patrol rural areas, looking for cattle thieves and other lawbreakers.
In the late 1910s, the role of Rangers in Texas was once again called into question as violence and scandal breached public trust and challenged their role as frontier heroes. In 1915, tensions between Anglos and ethnic Mexicans along the Texas-Mexico border exploded into violence between the two groups. To restore order, Governor James Ferguson sent hundreds of Texas Rangers, including many brand new Special Rangers, to the border to quell the violence. The Rangers implemented their own brand of lynch law against Mexicans and Tejanos. They executed at least 300 suspected Mexicans without any trial or conviction. The governor warned the Rangers to stop executing Mexicans, but the violence continued for several more years. Finally, in 1919, a joint committee investigation found the Rangers broke the law repeatedly and engaged in unwarranted violence. The appointments of almost all the Special Rangers were canceled, several companies of regular Rangers disbanded, and both new and existing members were subjected to more stringent qualifications.
Under the new leadership of Captains William L. Wright, Thomas R. Hickman, and Frank Hamer, the Rangers reformed as a more professional force in the 1920s. During this time, they returned to their law enforcement duties, patrolling for smugglers and cattle rustlers on the border. However, in 1932, just as they were again becoming a recognized and respected law enforcement agency, the Rangers made a major political blunder with ruinous consequences. The Rangers backed incumbent Governor Ross Sterling against Miriam Ma Ferguson. When Ferguson was elected, she fired every Ranger on the force for supporting her opponent. The Rangers were effectively disbanded, now known as highwaymen and assigned strictly to patrolling and traffic-related duties. The once proud Rangers had to rebuild their ranks from scratch. The new recruits weren't up to the task, and even if they had been, their new status as essentially highway patrolmen gave them little leeway in their jurisdiction off the blacktop or in their ability to investigate serious crimes. As a result, Texas experienced a new era of lawlessness throughout the early 1930s.
Then came Bonnie and Clyde. Texas law enforcement at the time, and even federal authorities, seemed unable to catch up to the murderous duo, who were rampaging across Texas and surrounding areas, murdering and robbing without compunction. Texas Governor Ma Ferguson found herself under political fire with few options. Legendary Ranger Frank Hamer and his partner were lured out of retirement to bring their old-school skills of tracking an investigation to bear on Bonnie and Clyde. Initially ignored by the FBI and others as irrelevant, Hamer, of course, would bring about the ultimate and deadly downfall of the murderous duo.
The demise of Bonnie and Clyde at the hands of Frank Hamer and his partner proved to be a turning point, leading directly to the reestablishment of the Texas Rangers as the detective arm of the Texas Department of Public Safety. Their uniformed law enforcement duties were reassigned more appropriately to highway patrol officers. This reinstatement also came with an interesting caveat, as it was written into state law that the Texas Rangers could never be dissolved again.
An amazing book covering all of this and far more is Texas Ranger, The Epic Life of Frank Hamer, the Man Who Killed Bonnie and Clyde, by best-selling nonfiction writer John Bosenecker. Like many of Bosenecker's books, this one is densely packed with information, but Bosenecker is a great writer and storyteller, and the pages fly by. This is one of the best books I've read in the past year, and I highly recommend it for anyone interested in the history of the Texas Rangers and the man who is one of the toughest of them all, and was also part of all of the ups and questionable downs of Texas Ranger history.
Despite all the controversy surrounding them, the image of the Texas Ranger has been one of romance and adventure. The nation was first introduced to the Texas Rangers by news dispatches and stories chronicling their heroic deeds during the Mexican War. The Ranger and the ranging tradition soon became a theme in popular culture. Texas Rangers were celebrated as individuals who could fight and prevail against overwhelming odds and survive the harsh frontier conditions.
Texas Rangers became the icon for rugged individualism, courage, honesty, and virtue. Songs, poetry, and novels about the Rangers were common as early as the 1850s. Today, movies, radio, television, sports teams, toys, and games keep the popular image alive.
Before we move on, though, I know you have some interesting comments regarding the portrayal of Frank Hamer and his involvement with Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, we've spoken often about how the bad guys of the West somehow become folk heroes completely out of sync with the reality of their murderous ways. Bonnie and Clyde are clearly no exception to this phenomenon. The gunslinging pair, memorably played by Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in Arthur Penn's now classic 1967 film Bonnie and Clyde, the duo are portrayed as iconic anti-heroes in the same weird way as Billy the Kid, Jesse James, and others. Their actions glamorized and made to appear justified. In the film, Frank Hamer, played by Denver Pyle, sporting a villainous mustache, is portrayed as a vindictive, incompetent boob who is captured and humiliated by the Barrow Gang before hunting them down for revenge. In reality, Hamer was never captured by Bonnie and Clyde, and the portrayal of his character in the film was so far off the mark, Hamer's family sued the film's producers for defamation of character and won a huge out-of-court settlement.
And rightfully so, Hamer was legendary long before he gunned down Bonnie and Clyde. As part of the Texas Rangers, he fought Mexicans, Native Americans, bank robbers, and bootleggers across Texas and along the border. Known for his ability to control riots and his patient, skilled investigative work, he became a senior captain of the Rangers in 1922 when he fearlessly took on the Ku Klux Klan. He resigned in 1932 when Ma Ferguson, who, as we mentioned, detested the Rangers, became governor. He then turned to mostly private investigation work before being brought back into the fold to hunt down Bonnie and Clyde. In a 1934 interview, Bob Elkhorn, a member of the Barrow Hunt, called Hamer one of the bravest men and deadliest shots in the state.
A far more accurate portrayal of Hamer can be seen in the 2019 film The Highwaymen, in which Kevin Costner plays Hamer as a dogged investigator whose old-school techniques and skills are more than a match for modern investigators, whom he out-savvies at every turn. Along for the ride is his long-suffering partner Manny Gault, played to perfection by Woody Harrelson. The pair shake off dust and creaking joints in their quest to rekindle their old glory from fighting wars together against Mexican forces. The film accurately depicts Hamer's painstaking attention to detail and the long stretches of monotony he was willing to endure to catch his quarry. His patience paid off when he uncovered a pattern in which Bonnie and Clyde would make loops rampaging around the South only to return home to their families, a pattern that ultimately led to the ambush led by Hamer that shot Bonnie and Clyde to doll rags in May 1934 with a hail of gunfire.
I understand the grotesque scene at the end of the film, in which hordes of people are seen surrounding the bullet hole-ridden Ford carrying the pair's bodies, with officials pushing back those trying to grab at the corpses, actually happen in real life.
Absolutely. In his book Go Down Together, The True Story of Bonnie and Clyde, Jeff Quinn states, "One man tried to cut off Clyde's ear. Somebody with scissors managed to snip off locks of Bonnie's hair and bits of her gory dress before being pulled away."
Anything for a souvenir.
Yeah, a souvenir is one thing, but ears and locks of hair from heads of murderers are hardly the kind of items you're going to find in the tourist trap shops.
And there's the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle, partner, telling us to wrap up this episode and get on with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks also to our other sponsors, author Chris Entz and the Western Writers of America. Thanks also to Roundup Magazine and Saddlebag Dispatches for their support in promoting our podcast.
Next Monday, Paul will be hosting a Six Gun Justice Speed Listen featuring everything you need to know about author Don Coldsmith and his Spanish Bit Saga series, all in under 15 minutes, give or take.
And in 2 weeks, we'll be back with another episode of the Six Gun Justice podcast featuring the Texas Rangers Part 2.
And don't forget our Six Gun Justice conversation segments every Wednesday, when either Paul or I get to hang out around the Six Gun Justice Corral talking with writers and friends who love the Western genre as much as we do.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and never cross a ranger.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.